Dorling, who's the Halford and Kinder Professor of Geography, and BBC Car Talk in 2014 named him Britain's leading social thinker. He's an expert group advisory member of the United Nations World Economic and Social Survey, and I'd like to introduce him to introduce the other panel members and to start the panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've just got under an hour. The way we're going to do this is we're each going to talk for about 8 or 9 minutes, leaving a whole half an hour for you to quiz us, make points, and so on. I'm Danny, and I'm based in the Geography Department here. I'm going to be speaking second. First of all, you're going to get Brian Nolan from many places, but let's just say Nuffield College for now. And last of all, we're going to have Fran Bennett from Social Policy and Intervention. So thank you very much for coming back this afternoon. I hope you find it fine. Please hold your questions in for about 28 minutes and then there'll be lots of opportunity. Thank you.
Good afternoon. So what I want to talk about is economic inequality and honing in on a very specific aspect of economic inequality, and that is inequality in the distribution of income. We can talk about the distribution of wealth, which is a very important complementary component in the discussion. But I just want to try and flag up for you, because it's what much of the debate about growing inequality has focused on, what's been happening to income inequality in the rich countries of the world, and why we should care. So there are a number of different aspects to this, and naturally there are different ways of trying to capture a complex phenomenon such as inequality, even in the distribution of something relatively concrete like income. But what this slide, just to graphically illustrate, shows you is that the most widely used single summary measure of income inequality, called the Gini coefficient, and how that's been trending in the English-speaking, what generally get grouped together as a set of countries with rather liberal, rather than highly regulated or high social spending countries, the English-speaking rich countries. And I should say that almost everything I'm going to say applies to the rich countries, which is essentially the countries that group together in the OECD. So it is the case that, and it's becoming increasingly obvious over the last number of years, coming up to the crisis, that in a clear majority of the rich countries, the OECD countries, income inequality has been rising, and rising markedly in many of them. So it is not the case that it has risen a lot everywhere, but it's certainly the case that there has been a significant rise in at least two-thirds of the OECD countries, and only a small number where essentially no increase in income inequality has been seen. Important to stress that this is the case well before the economic crisis. And as you'll see illustrated here for these English-speaking countries, substantial increases, for example, for the UK, in the sort of purple line there, and going back to the Thatcher era of the 1980s, some increase subsequently, but with the bulk of the increase concentrated in that Thatcher era, if you like. Whereas for other countries, there's been a different phasing, a different time pattern, but nonetheless, for most countries, with the exception, interestingly, of my own Ireland, there has been a marked increase. Now you might say, well, that's because these are welfare states that are relatively low tax, relatively low social spending, and have led the charge in terms of deregulation and reliance on the market, particularly over this period from the late 1970s. You might be interested then to look at the countries that we normally think of as being at the other end of that spectrum. In other words, relatively high tax, high social spend, and highly developed welfare states. And you'll see here that in most of those as well, again with a somewhat different pattern over time across them, but nonetheless, income inequality measured this way, and this Gini coefficient is trying to capture inequality across the whole distribution and not particularly heavily weighting what's going on at the top or the bottom. So it's an overall statistical measure of dispersion. And what you see is that there's been very marked increases in inequality in the traditionally low inequality countries of Scandinavia and the Netherlands. So what's going on? Well, the usual suspects or culprits in this discussion are, of course, the nature and pace of technological change, combined with globalization, the opening up of markets to trade and to capital flows, and indeed flows of labor as well. So the notion, and there seems to be certainly some truth to it, is that technological change has served to boost the demand for those with high skills, high levels of cognitive skills and education, and biased against those with lower levels of marketable skills. So that's what technology is doing, with the nuance that in more recent times it may have been hollowing out the middle rather than the lower part of the earnings distribution, with what gets called routinization. It's replacing relatively well-paid but routine tasks in more recent times to some extent. But that technology, combined with the fact that emerging economies, notably, of course, China and India, are now competing very much more actively with particularly low-wage workers in the rich countries. So I think a very important point to stress, and one that we may want to come back to in the discussion, is that, of course, this has been very good news for many people in those developing countries that have seen very significant growth, very significant increases in living standards. So we might come back to the balance, if you like, of global advantage. But it's quite clear that for the less skilled in the rich countries, times have been very tough. In terms of what explains this overall pattern of increasing inequality, though, it's important to be clear that it's not just about what's happening in the market. There are also changes in family structures, in demography, in age profiles, and so on, that have played some role, a relatively modest but some role. But it's also clear that redistribution, the extent to which the state effectively redistributes the market, the incomes generated in the market, that's also contributed to increasing inequality. And you know that's clearly the case here in the UK, but if you look at these Scandinavian countries, there are particular changes in tax codes and in welfare systems that you can point to that have demonstrable effects in terms of contributing to increasing inequality. So that's partly a wave of cuts in marginal income tax rates, corporate taxes, in some cases taxes on assets, capital, wealth, transfer, and so on. And because welfare systems have been, if you want to put it this way, adapting to the imperatives of a more competitive global environment. So so it's clear that there are deep-seated economic forces driving inequality upwards, but that policy has a significant role to play. Now that's about inequality across the distribution as a whole, but you'll well know that much of the discussion and much of the debate, much of the most active and heated debate about increasing inequality has been about what's happening at the top. So what this shows is not inequality across the whole distribution, but it shows the share of total income going to those at the very top, the top 1%. And in fact, if you hone in on an even smaller group, the top 0.1%, you get an even more striking picture. So what you see is that in most countries, this is a selection from a invaluable database called the World Top Income Database that Tony Atkinson and colleagues, including Tom Abidi, have labored very hard on constructing, that you can see that a striking component of what's happened to income inequality is the extent to which the very, very top has benefited. So this gives rise to slogans like "We're the 99%," the Occupy movement, and so on. There are a number of different components here as well. What's happening to pay of top executives, CEO pay, has ballooned relative to pay of the ordinary worker. The growth in the finance sector and its rewards has played a very important role here and in the USA. And then the role of, if you like, superstars more generally in sport and media and so on. So this is an important component of the overall rise in income inequality that has been seen in many countries. So why worry? Well, that's in some sense up to you to decide. It's up to your values about inequality, but there are also some, if you like, instrumental reasons. Because we think that increasing inequality may bring with it a worsening in things that we certainly care about in and of themselves, such as health inequalities, crime, and family breakdown, and so on. More recently, over the last number of years, through the crisis, there's been a real concern that higher income inequality may make the economy function much less effectively and may feed into what's now getting called secular stagnation or the risk of secular stagnation. But it seems to me that we're also, apart from those instrumental reasons, which I think are well worth debating and thinking about and studying, and there's been a lot of research on them, we're also entitled to think about inequality in and of itself and whether the gaps that have now emerged, particularly between the top and the rest, are in some sense wider than is acceptable or necessary to generate growth and prosperity for the bulk of the distribution, and is in fact a barrier to doing so. So then, just to finish on that global picture that I mentioned, so is growing inequality in the rich countries simply a price we should be willing to pay for greater global prosperity? And if you measure global income inequality in the conventional way, you do see that that does seem to be declining because of the pace of, and extent of growth in particularly China and India. Well, I guess it would be a debate if you thought that was necessary to underpin that global growth. Well, there's no reason to think it is. There's no reason to think that higher inequality in the West, if we don't think about it, or the North, is in any sense contributing to that growth in the South. There are policies we could be adopting here in the OECD countries that we talk about in the discussion that could generate broader prosperity and underpin demand for the imports from the newly emerging economies and benefit them too. So I look forward to hearing your views in the discussion, having heard the other contributions.
Thank you.
I agreed with all of that apart from one thing, which was when you were very magnanimous and said it's up to you. It's partly up to you to decide whether inequality is a problem, but we have some evidence that how people think is actually affected by the nature of the society that they grow up in and live in. And people in more unequal societies come to accept inequality more. So it may not be so much up to you. You may have been bred and brought up and taught to believe that there are great differences between people and they're justified. For instance, you might have arrived at this university and somebody told you you're the best of the best, you're the creme de la creme, you're so wonderful. You may just have had that kind of speech at the first week when you're here. That kind of thing doesn't happen in more equitable, affluent countries. So you may not be capable of understanding just how much of a problem inequality is. I'm a geographer, so I like maps. This is a map of supposed top universities. It's stretched, you may not have seen this before, but remember you have wonderful minds, so you can cope with this. And I've only got 7 minutes. That's the population distribution of the world. We're now going to put it over GDP, and you see that the universities are spread a bit more evenly over the money. This really is the heart of the money. It's wonderful to be in a lecture theatre where the mics are finally invisible. To see, and you'll see that China doesn't have enough universities yet, top ones, for the money it's got there, and the world is kind of changing. There's other ways in which the world is changing, which people are linking all the way through to inequality. One is climate change. This is a typhoon from a couple of years ago, and we can make it look a bit more dramatic if your knowledge of that part of the world is not great, by pretending it's over this part of the world, and then suddenly it looks a bit bigger than it looked like before. Or we can look at the whole world, which we'll just do very quickly now. This is a familiar image. You would have seen this kind of image of the world at night before. You won't have seen it spread on this map. You're now looking at that image over a population surface, which means that if it's dark in that image, there are people there, And those people either don't have electricity, or they're so sensible that they're not choosing to spend that electricity shining light up into the sky for the benefit of the satellite. And again, in terms of how the world is changing, if you look at the Nile, we'll just go back a few years, to an earlier picture, and you'll see the Nile and Cairo just lit up. I haven't got time to go through it, but there's kind of good news stories here that the brightest area of the world a few years ago was Tokyo. And Tokyo is now a bit dimmer because Tokyo has proved you can turn off a quarter of your electricity supply and still survive. You've just got to turn some lights off at night. And finally, just to really stretch your mind before I show you what I wanted to show you, if we take out the oceans, you get a very different shape of the world. And suddenly, rather than being at the centre of the world, at the power in the number one university in Europe, you're at a little rock on the edge of the planet, which is 1% of the world's population, or only 0.5% of the world's children. You can look at the same thing in different ways again and again and see different images. I'm going to skip that. I've got five graphs to show you and one conclusion. Those are the 25 richest countries with at least 2 million people, so a subset of the OECD. And here they are. They look big when you look at them by wealth. And I'm going to look at inequality in these countries when it clips forward. This is a measure a little bit like the Gini measure. It's the ratio of the household income of the best off tenth to the poorest tenth in each country, taken a few years ago. There are dramatic differences in the richest countries on the planet. Capitalism is different in different highly successful capitalist countries. The most unequal is Singapore. After that, the United States, with the best off tenth for living on about 16 times more money than the poorest tenth. After that, Portugal, although I suspect it's changed in recent years, because Portugal's become poorer and the poor had almost nothing in Portugal, so it's probably become more equal. And after that, the United Kingdom, which is more unequal than Israel, and that's including everybody in Israel. And you often look at Israel and you probably see it as quite an unequal country, so you need to look again at this country. Fran and I have an interest in Oxford, and Oxford is currently the most expensive city in the UK. The income to house price gap is now 16 to 1, it's beating London, because London has slightly higher incomes. And I've been trying to stay out of this, so I'm not going to be here for this debate, so it's going to be held in the university next week, but really, only in an incredibly unequal country could you debate spending £30 million removing 47 dwellings from postgraduate students. I'll stay out of that, but it's really interesting to look at stupidity and the measures of inequality. Okay. What I'm going to show you next is speculative, these five graphs. And the reason I'm showing them to you is because I have a selfish motive. I would like one or two of you to look at this and do it properly. I looked at these things about 8 years ago. As a result of looking at them 8 years ago, 1 year ago I end up in the UN building on the 24th floor contributing to the World Economic Survey. And all I did was show them this. So all you need to do is look at a few things like this. And what I'm going to show you are correlations. Not causation, it's correlations. It's as dodgy as when somebody first worked out how many cigarettes doctors smoked and put it against their chances of having lung cancer. Right, it's just a correlation. Doesn't mean you've understood what's going on, but it's really, really interesting. And the interesting thing is, for some reason, in the more unequal countries, people seem to consume more. Everybody appears to consume more. The USA, they consume the most meat. 120 kilograms a year of meat. That's everybody. We'd solve inequality if just the rich did that, because they would die very, very quickly. If you've ever seen Super Size Me, you'll know. It's everybody eating more meat, which is why people get most obese in the US. We're at 80 kilograms. This includes fish, by the way. Japan's down at 40. Incredible difference in behaviour, which appears to be related in some way to inequality. It may be related to some other intervening variable, but it's just there. This little dot up here, by the way, is Denmark. There are always exceptions, and they're always interesting. Water, just residential water use, not agriculture, not industry. And again, a relationship, and you've got to ask yourself why. Again, as an outlier, I think I can say why. It really isn't worth having a swimming pool in this country. Although it's remarkable how many people do have them, and they're always empty. Private swimming pools are just not being used. This is the third measure. This is the amount of kilograms of waste people produce a year. Waste is brilliant. It means we can work out how much you buy. Apart from jewellery, which you tend to keep, and food, which exits in another way, everything you buy you put in the dustbin, often very quickly after having bought it. Clothes are the most interesting one on this. And people in more equitable countries appear to buy slower, more carefully, and keep it for longer. And lastly, a bit more dubious, that's one more, but this is flights. So in Germany, people develop train systems and use them. In the USA, they don't have pavements in some towns. And the question is it connected? I'll skip over this one because the data is dodgy, but it may just be there's nothing much there. It's a footprint measure. Those are the data sources. You can look at this, just email me, I'll send you the slides. Somebody needs to update this, somebody needs to look into this further. How much is inequality affecting our behaviour? The argument here is that if everybody in the world behaved like the USA, we would need four planets. If everybody behaves as well as the Japanese, we only need two. The bad news is we haven't got two, but, you know, you're getting there. And one last picture for me. Things. This really is incredibly new. This kind of is something else going on. Along the bottom, you've got the take of the 1%, which, as Brian was showing, in the US is heading up towards 20%. In the Netherlands, it's down about 6%. In Denmark, it's low. And along the y-axis, you've got the proportion of people who walk or cycle to work. In the US, it's 3.5%. In the Netherlands, it's 50%. Here, just 1% of pensioners cycle. I suspect most of them actually in Oxford. Just 1%. In Germany, it's about 9%. In the Netherlands, it's 25% of pensioners cycle. You cannot paint your own cycle lanes. You require a society to be well organised to sort out your transport so that you can cycle well. There really is something interesting going on. It's not just that inequality is bad in general and a waste of money and makes people behave in awful ways at the very top. Is there a connection between societies who manage to let their greedy get loose and become greedier also fail to do other very basic things like work out how to get their schools working properly, their transport systems working properly, their energy working properly, how not to eat so many burgers, all the way through to learning that you don't have to have a swimming pool in your garden to feel happy. And I'll end with that to keep us on time. But please, anybody does want to update those graphs and end up in the UN in 8 years' time, just send me an email. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm going to talk without any nice pictures. I'm half-time in the Department of Social Policy and Intervention. I'm going to draw on the other half of my life as well in what I'm going to say. And I'm going to focus in particular on the UK because that's what I know best. But first, I just wanted to underline what both the other speakers have said, which is that inequality is increasingly being recognised as an issue. And it isn't just the Pope who's saying that. It's not just Oxfam, it's not just the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of York. In fact, the Archbishop of York said it's the greatest demon of all time. It's not just Summers and Ed Balls, and it's not just Obama, but it's also Christine Lagarde of the International Monetary Fund, and it's also the OECD, and it's also the chief US economist of Standard and Poor's, etc., etc. Inequality is increasingly being recognised as an issue that we need to do something about. And as Brian said, within developed countries, inequality has generally been increasing. Between countries of the world, it's actually generally been falling recently. And it does vary, as both speakers have said. So Danny, for example, has done some work comparing the UK and Japan in particular, and income inequality is definitely different between those. And again, as Brian said, I think we need to think about inequality of what? And what's most important? Inequality of income, inequality of wealth, which tends to be greater than inequality of income, and perhaps most importantly, inequality of power, which I'm going to say a bit more about in a minute. I wanted to move us on a bit to talking about something about what we should do, which Brian talked about as well. Redistribution via tax and benefits has been seen as central often, and particularly up to now, and it's particularly important perhaps in the UK because of the initial distribution of income being so unequal. But some people have been arguing recently that this has run its course and that we need to think of other methods of changing the distribution of income. And I went to a policy network conference being held in here in Oxford recently, which was talking particularly about pre-distribution. So should we be focusing more of our energies on pre-distribution? And it'd be interesting to hear what people think about this. That means raising wage floors, enabling progression from low-paid work to higher-paid work, facilitating a higher-wage business model, if you like, to begin with. And also, perhaps more generally, that's about boosting the wage share in terms of the distribution between profits and wages. This also overlaps with an approach which the European Union has particularly been pushing recently, which is social investment. And that tends to mean more focus on improving education, including early years education, childcare, for young children, and also training, in particular vocational training is often seen in this way, and more generally something called human capital investment. So human capital investment becoming more important in terms of what you think it may do in the distribution of income to redistribution. But I just wanted to put some question marks over that in terms of looking at pre-distribution by itself. And that's particularly because of the findings about how much tax and benefit systems do reduce inequality. A Euromod study, for example, in 2010, particularly found that public pensions and direct taxes are especially important in doing that. And another study found that in developed countries, tax and benefit systems offset about two-thirds of the average increase in primary inequality. It's also the case that we could think about these as complementary strategies. For example, the Fabian Society, in a forthcoming report, is going to be talking about pre-distribution providing the money for redistribution. In other words, you can then have more in taxation if you are initially trying to boost pre-distribution as well. So I think we should see these perhaps as complementary rather than alternative strategies, as they've tended to be talked about recently. I also wanted to say, what about poverty? And that's partly because I do work on poverty, and poverty and inequality are not the same things, but I think it's important to talk about poverty because it's, as Ruth Lister said, nested in inequalities, really, of various kinds. And I learnt in particular from my experience of working in the UK Poverty Programme in Oxfam, which is based here in Oxford, of course, and I was trying to understand how Oxfam could have a UK poverty programme when it was basically invested largely in poverty abroad, poverty in the so-called developing countries, the global south. And it was quite a struggle, I think, intellectually to understand that, more so than, I have to say, anything I've done in my academic time. But I think what we came to was that whilst the degree of poverty may be different in different countries, the causes and consequences are actually very, very similar in nature. And that's the way in which you can also nest poverty in the UK in terms of global inequality. And in particular, that the causes are about, as Narayan et al. Said for the World Bank, power relations determining the access to resources at every level for those in poverty. So from the household, which I'm going to say a bit more about in a minute, from the household upwards at every level, household, local, national, international. And in terms of the consequences, you can see poverty as a shameful and corrosive social relationship, which is also something from Ruth Lister. So the inequality of respect is a shameful relationship that people in poverty experience. And you could argue that that is worse in a more unequal society. And my colleagues, Robert Walker and Elaine Chase, have done an international research about poverty and shame. And I think you could argue that with the conspicuous consumption and the social exclusion of the better off, if you like, in a very unequal society, that could lead to the worsening of what is called the othering of the poor. In other words, seeing people in poverty as those who are different from the rest of us. I just wanted to say briefly not to forget about two other areas of inequality. One is local inequality, which Danny mentioned, in terms of Oxford. And you can look at inequality by area as well as by individual households over any area. And there are different levels as well at which action can be taken to tackle inequality. And of course that can include you. So we talk about thinking globally and acting locally. And A.H. Halsey, who was a great sociologist who used to be in our department, talked about Oxford University as, well, and Oxford as well, actually, the place engulfs you. It wraps itself around you rhetorically and architecturally, which is a way of saying that it's quite easy for us not to see the other Oxford when we're in Oxford University. And I have quite a lot to do with the Advice Centre in Blackburn Leas. I'm not going to have time to talk about that now. But that is a very different part of Oxford, and the experience of that feeds itself very importantly into the way in which I experience Oxford as a whole whilst living here. And the last thing I wanted to say, which is another area of my both academic and personal work, is just not to forget other inequalities, particularly gender. So you can look at redistribution and inequalities in terms of lots of different ways. So age groups, for example, is another one. And we know at the moment that pensioners are being advantaged by the social policies of the coalition government. But I've in particular been involved in trying to help with the analysis of inequalities according to gender. And in that way, we have to actually look inside the household as well as between households, and talk about the redistribution of resources within the family so that that becomes another level at which resources are actually distributed and redistributed. And that can happen over the life course as well. And so my argument would be that we don't just look at households in general, but we also look at the analysis of inequalities between individuals and over the life course rather than just households at one point in time. Thank you.
Thank you, Fran. Thank you.